This is Wayne Pond with Soundings. By popular and scholarly consensus, Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud are major cultural and intellectual figures of the 19th century whose influences clearly extend into the 20th. But what's the nature of Marxist and Freudian thought in the 1980s when compared to what the two men originally set forth? Soundings invited two scholars at the National Humanities Center to address that question. Werner Danhauser teaches in the Department of Government at Cornell. Stephen Marcus is a professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia. Professor Danhauser begins the conversation referring to W.H. Auden's epithet, describing the 20th century as an age of anxiety, attributable in part to Marx and Freud.
Well, I think Auden at the time was in his more Freudian stage rather than Marxist. But I think our time certainly isn't a happy one, and that's what convinced Marxists and Freudians would agree on. I think they would have rather severe quarrels as to what the source of the wrong is. But it's certainly not a good century.
Well, my sense is that generally people associate Freudianism or Marxism, those very broad terms, with negative or the dark side, with forces that are difficult to grapple with in politics or your personal life. With regard to Marx, is that fair, Werner?
I think it's more fair of Freud than of Marx. Mm-hmm. I think Marx ultimately is a tremendous optimist, whereas Freud's picture, if I understand it correctly, remains much more bleak. I mean, I think Marx made the most amazing statement of optimism in the 19th century, or one of them, when he said that mankind sets itself no tasks that it cannot solve. And that means sooner or later, everything will be all right. Now, I think Freud said there may be amelioration, or individuals can get better, but if I understand him correctly, he saw no particular solution for man's lot, certainly no utopia.
I agree with him. Marx was a revolutionary, and being a revolutionary, almost by definition, had to be an optimist, unless you're a revolutionary who thinks the revolution is going to lose. And Freud was certainly revolutionary in his thought, but he was not a revolutionary socially.
He wasn't deliberately revolutionary.
He was deliberately revolutionary in his thinking. There's no question of that. He was he wanted to make a radical new theory of how human beings were. But he certainly did not believe that a social revolution would put an end to the ills or discontents of mankind. However, there is at one point, it seems to me, where they both converge here, which makes for an interesting complication. Both of them place the role of conflict as central to life as we've known it until now. That is to say, Marx sees social conflict or class conflict as central, and Freud sees conflicts between inner impulses of various kinds and between the individual person and civilization as constitutive of existence. The difference between them is that Marx, it's possible for Marx to envisage, although he doesn't talk about it very much, sometime in the future when the revolution has taken place where these great conflicts will have been done away with. And that, for Freud, is an impossible vision.
In other words, for Marx, the revolution was an end, and for Freud, it's a means. It's something that...
Well, for Marx, I think the revolution was, you would say, it was not the end, but it was, as he said at some point, wouldn't you agree, with the beginning.
Yes.
He thought human history, after the revolution, human history could then begin.
And what was it that that Marx, for instance, envisioned, Werner?
Well, I want to agree with Stephen that he was after a beginning, in some sense a new beginning, in some sense man's coming into his own. Mm-hmm. And I think it's relatively clear to all people who call themselves Marxists that what Marxism involves is a kind of vision of a glorious human future with a glorious individual fulfillment of everyone. How that is to look and how that's to be brought about is where there's very little agreement, or especially how it's to be brought about and when it's possible, where it's possible, how it's possible. And I think the Freudian answer would be on the side of it's not possible, because human beings will be human beings and they will have this conflict. Perhaps an individual coming to terms is possible. A man can conceivably become good or healthy. But if you look at all the things that stand in the way of one individual's coming to terms with his own demons, you have to think that the mathematical possibility of a whole new race of human beings, as it were, or new souls, borders on the impossible, if it isn't actually impossible.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me agree and put it in another way to bring out both the, I think what we're both talking about are similarities and contrasts at the same time. The early Marx, at least, believed that human beings were living in what he called an alienated state, that the nature of social development and economic development had produced a state of affairs in which every human being, or every working, laboring human being's essential human essence had been alienated from him. And what he originally thought of as the revolution achieving would be would be disalienation. That is, the reappropriation by man of his own humanity. Insofar as psychoanalysis represents a therapeutic effort at introspection and at refinding, as it were, a center of oneself that one has lost and reintegrating oneself, there is a similarity.
And here's where they come together.
Here is where they come. Marx, however, believed that it could happen on a historical and global scale. Uh-huh. Freud, however, had more, as it were, modest aims and views. He thought it could be done. It had to be done one by one. However, as you recall, I think, in Civilization and the Discontents, I believe he says at one point, well, perhaps if men's relation to property changed, a great difference could be made in history. So at least there is a small there is that one sentence which represents a small opening in Freud toward in that direction.
I am more struck, I think we're using Freud as Holy Writ now, by a passage somewhere, I think it's in a new introductory lectures at a time when the Soviet Union had many more friends than it does now, where he says something like, one only wonders what the Soviet Union do when they don't have their kulaks to kick around anymore.
He was highly skeptical of the Soviet experiment. Mm-hmm. There's no question of that. More than skeptical, I would say. But yeah. he does write this sentence about if men's relation to property changed, something large might happen.
Does Marxism assume an equality that simply isn't there in human nature, or strive for a desire for an equality that just is not there?
Well, I happen to think so, but I think in fairness to Marx, you would say it has a rather, now I'm going to be unfair again, what is for me a rather attenuated view of human nature. It just holds that human nature is enormously malleable, plastic, and can be fashioned by the proper environment or by the proper world, if you will.
Let me add, a qualification in agreement with that. After some early attempts at predicting what the disalienated world would be like, Marx gave up doing so, and then went on to make a statement that one cannot, as it were, predict or talk about the realm of freedom when one is living in the realm of necessity. And we are all in the realm of necessity, and therefore one cannot see what the realm of freedom will be like from the realm of necessity. That is to say, on second thoughts, he, as it were, refrained from talking about what that uh-huh. future would be like, and did not set up, as it were, to be a full-scale prophet in the sense that, say, of an Auguste Comte, who would lay out what the entire future would be like.
A couple of words that you've used here, freedom, necessity, alienation. Werner, Stephen, why is it that popularly, at any rate, well, for Marxism, for instance, why is that associated with godlessness, with anti-religion? Is it?
Well, I think Marx was a forthright atheist, and I think in the development of his thought, the kind of insistence on atheism plays a large role. Now, godlessness is a pejorative term. Marx would put that in terms of man's ultimate liberation from all sorts of false consciousness, and therefore from the fetters that religion has always placed on man.
So it isn't anti-God so much as it is just rising above religion or indifference to religion?
No, I wouldn't want to say that. No. Since we're talking about Marx and Freud.
He and Freud were both uncompromising atheists.
Yes, and I think that's one important thing they do have in common.
Mm-hmm. Now, however, and although Marx was, as it were, in general opposed to religion, what one forgets is that in his most famous and quoted statement about religion, that it's the opium of the people, he goes on to say, it's the opium of the people, but then he says, it is the soul of a soulless world. That is to say, he's not just simply saying, as it were, that it's the opium. He says he's talking about the soul, and that the world needs a soul, and man has a soul, you know, and that the world as it exists now is soulless. I do think he believed that men could do without religion in its received forms. Mm-hmm. He certainly did not believe that men could do without beliefs, you know, and without meanings. And I think this is another thing that he and Freud have in common, as opposed to the 20th century, is that both of them believed that existence was not meaningless, that it was profoundly meaningful, and that man discovers and creates meaning in life, and that's what life is about.
It simply doesn't focus on the notion of a Christian God or a received God, deity.
They are atheists, but they are not nihilists, mm-hmm. in the Nietzschean sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, at that part, I think I disagree slightly. I mean, I think they both do believe that man creates meaning. But for me, and not only for me, that leaves open the question whether it can really be meaning in the traditional sense if it's something you have to create.
Consensus.
Whether meaning, in the ultimate sense, isn't always something that's beyond our power to make.
And I think that for them, however, whose lives themselves were so profoundly involved in their own creativity, you know, the finding and creating of meaning in life, which was coterminous with their own activity, you know, was itself a transcendent activity.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about the influences of Marx and Freud in the 20th century with two scholars at the National Humanities Center, Werner Danhauser of Cornell University and Stephen Marcus of Columbia. Let me put it to you this way. Are people today finding in Marx and Freud answers to political and social and personal questions that they themselves, Marx and Freud, weren't aware of or didn't ask? Or does human nature stay pretty constant? Are the questions fair?
I've taken a kind of vow never to underestimate people's awareness. So I try to say, no, in one way or another, both Marx and Freud were aware of all the questions. As to how adequately they answered them, I can only say that I grew up in an atmosphere where they answered all questions. Marx answered all questions about injustice in the world, and Freud answered all questions about why we had acne and were so personally miserable and so forth. And since then, that's become too neat, and neither answers all the questions. But I think, in a way, they had a picture of man and his fate, I guess you would call it, that in principle addresses itself mm-hmm. to all the important questions.
Have Marx and Freud become false gods in the 20th century?
Well, of course they've both become false gods. They've been misused by wide varieties of people. But let me put it in a slightly different way. I find it, and I think most thinking people, find it impossible to to conceive of the modern world without these two figures. Mm-hmm. That is to say, they themselves are constitutive of a good part or of some important parts of the modern world and of our awareness of how the world is shaped. And they represent, as it were, parallel but different, as it were, traditions in it. For example, it seems to me that it's quite clear that there's a direct line of descent, as it were, from the Greeks to Freud, from the inscription over the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, "Know thyself," to psychoanalysis. You can trace a direct line. Psychoanalysis is Western civilization's most developed form of introspection. That is to say, other Eastern civilizations have their forms of introspection. Psychoanalysis is Western civilization's, as it were, most advanced discipline of introspection. Marx, on the other hand, represents another tradition, a tradition of writing of history and reading of history, which is, again, very solidly implanted in Western tradition, but he's not introspective the way Freud is. He's essentially a historical writer. Now, both of them, of course, conceive of almost everything historically. Freud in terms of personal history, Marx in terms of history of groups and classes and history of economic forms and social formations too. So they're both profoundly 19th century figures in the sense that their thought is rooted in historical thinking.
No, I would agree with almost all of that, and I just want to elaborate some strands of it. I think Stephen is right, certainly right in my personal case, and I suspect in all our cases, that between them, Marx and Freud somehow established the horizon in which we all think and talk. I mean, we can't do without thinking of the unconscious anymore, and we can't do without thinking about the quarrels or the struggles between the rich and the poor and some form of class struggle like that.
I would also say that even if you were to, as it were, be able to demonstrate at the moment that a large part of Marxist theory was wrong or even bankrupt, and that the same thing, and you could demonstrate the same thing about a large part of Freudian theory, there's nothing around to take their place. That is to say, there are no, as it were, big competing theories of comparable stature around, although some people may think there are, but there really aren't any, which are ready to step in and say, we're going to give alternative explanations of the whole, as it were, process or shebang, which are equivalent to the ones offered by these two thinkers.
Werner, what might Marx have said about what has happened to his doctrines in the 20th century? Sheer speculation.
Well, there, I am not one of those who reads the Soviet Union out of the Marxist camp. I'm one of those who has trouble with Marxism because of what happened in the Soviet Union. Not because I think it's...
not because the impurity of the doctrine.
Well, I don't think what Stalin did is, by no means, it's not the only interpretation of Marx. But I think, unfortunately, it is a possible interpretation of Marx. And so my answer to the question, which I phrase differently, is there a connection with mm-hmm. between Marx and the Gulag Archipelago?
And your answer
I
is?
I would have to say yes.
Mm-hmm. Werner, is there a Marxist experiment which has worked that you can look to and say, I won't criticize it, or I can't criticize it so quickly?
No, I think I would be most fair to Marx if I said there's no Marxist experiment that has worked hitherto, mm-hmm. but we're still engaged in the struggle. I mean, one thing you can't say about Marxist thought is that it's become irrelevant, or that people aren't willing to live and to die for it.
Yes, that's one of the interesting things, is that, and here we come back to the religious, I think the quasi-religious element in it. It seems to be one of the few doctrines, or one of the few sets of beliefs around, that people are willing to die for. As one sees around the world,
it's happening now.
It offers people who have nothing, and who are suffering from various forms of poverty and exploitation and misery, hope, and a vision of the future which no other doctrine around has. And this is why we see people, I think, around the world willing to die for it.
Stephen, what about Freudian doctrine?
Nobody dies for it.
How would you say it's been handled or received by the American psychiatric community?
Well, that's a very complicated story. First of all, the Americans were the original people on medicalizing the model. That is, as compared to Freud and his European colleagues, who wanted to have psychoanalysts from every profession, the Americans wanted to make it a subspecialty of medicine and psychiatry and to have it controlled.
That penchant for specialization, huh?
The penchant, I think, for power and control among physicians, too. And so the medical model of psychoanalysis has been more dominating in America than it has been anywhere else. Now, a second Americanization took place in developments in psychoanalytic theory after World War II. And this was a development called ego psychology. It was mostly developed by a number of Austrian and German psychoanalysts who came here during the Hitler period as refugees. And it was developed in America during the period of the Second World War and the subsequent period of immense prosperity in America, and had and stressed, as it were, adaptation, success, and even some kind of conformity. Unlike the original Freudian model, or Freud's own thing, which stresses conflict, intractability, and difficulty. Now, those two American contributions to the history of psychoanalysis are not do not redound, as it were, to the glory of American culture, I would say.
No, I guess I would like to add or ask Stephen whether he would agree that there is something, this may be the inevitable fate of thinkers of their stature, but one finds in America, and I don't suppose only in America, both the trivialization of Marx and the trivialization of Freud, that psychoanalysis has kind of become almost a parlor game, and that alienation means almost nothing but unhappy in a very vague sense, and that all of this goes on.
Yeah, I entirely agree. I would say in the culture at large, alienation, as it was referred to let's say, the 1960s and early 1970s, became not what Marx was talking about, but the equivalent of unhappiness. That is to say, human unhappiness was seen as alienation. And a similar thing has happened not with psychoanalysis itself, but with its offshoots, namely therapy. America is turning into, as it were, a therapeutic community. There is no profession, virtually, in which therapy is not practiced now, from nursing to the clergy, to family counseling, to teaching, to counselors in schools. There is nowhere where something which has been affected somehow by the Freudian notion of therapy isn't being practiced.
How did this happen?
It happened because Americans profoundly believed that you can fix things up.
Optimistic.
That you can fix things up. If there's something wrong, you can fix it. And I think that part of the runaway, as it were, success, which is, as Werner says, clearly a trivialization and vulgarization, as it were, of Freudian theory in America, is that if you don't feel good, you can get it fixed up by a therapist.
What are the grave misconceptions about these two enormously influential figures?
Well, I think the gravest misconception would be to see Freud as somebody who was either a monomaniac and had just one idea, or who had constructed a system which was closed and which included everything. He was neither. He had many ideas, and sexuality was one of the central ones, but that was not the only one. He wanted to construct the general psychology, and also had theories of culture as well, too. And the other thing is that he is in the, as it were, rational empirical tradition, and in the genuine scientific tradition of Western thought, in the sense that his system is open-ended and subject to modification and improvement and amendment and correction all the time, and he meant it to be.
Werner?
Well, there's so many misconceptions about Marx that you can have a field day. I guess the two that occur to me most readily are kind of an easy moralizing, which is taken to be as Marxist, that, you know, the rich are always wicked and the poor are always saintly. Whereas, of course, the Marxist position is immeasurably more complicated. They're both caught in a context of history and economics. And the second one, for which some latter-day self-described Marxists bear a responsibility, is that the relationship between the economic and the non-economic is a simple thing, so that when anything happens, you can look at a profit ledger, for example, and find the true explanation. Now, Marx never thought it was that simple. He did believe that perhaps ultimately the economic was determining in the last analysis, but only in the last analysis, and he probably thought much more that it set limitations to what could happen. But the relationship between the economic, what he called the infrastructure and superstructure, is simply not anything that you can, you know, figure out in 5 minutes and then apply an easy label to.
In the later Marx, the relation, especially in his letters, the relations he stresses between the base or infrastructure and superstructure are extremely complex, and one simply cannot read off from the base what's happening in religion, ideas, literature, or even, as it were, politics sometimes. That is to say, a whole series of intermediate steps have to be gone through to get from, let's say, the forces and modes of production to culture, religion, and things like that.
I suppose you could look for a lot of whipping boys or villains here. The journalists, textbooks. How is it that ideas such as Marx's and Freud's filter down to us? In one form or another, the ideas finally reach us.
Well, there is a percolation theory of culture, as it were. I would say that it doesn't apply merely to Marx and to Freud, but to virtually all the great complex figures in history. The way they finally filter down or percolate down or come through is in some form that would be very surprising to them. And certainly resembles only in a modest way, and usually in a deformed way, what they originally wrote, because what they originally wrote is almost always quite complex.
Yeah, I agree. There seems to be a general kind of theory of decay that applies. I mentioned just two thinkers who I personally think of are of greater stature than either. Within the generation after Plato, you had Platonic skeptics and Platonic dogmatists. And neither was exactly wrong, but they were just partial readings of a kind of very complex unity that Plato had formed. And within a generation after Hegel, or even less, there were left-wing Hegelians and right-wing Hegelians. And both saw something that Hegel had said. The problem was that Hegel had managed to combine things that were in tension with each other. And after them, they fell apart. And I think something like that is that Marx and Freud are just likely to be smarter or greater than the people that write about Marx and Freud.
The same thing is true with Darwin, of course, who is the third great constitutive figure
in the 19th century in
modern thinking.
Yeah.
The popular debates that go on about evolution have very little to do with the state of Darwinian theory.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond inviting you to join me this week for Soundings. By popular and scholarly consensus, Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud are major cultural and intellectual figures of the 19th century, whose influences are inescapable in the 20th. But what's the nature of Marxist and Freudian thought in the 1980s when compared to what Marx and Freud themselves originally set forth? Two scholars at the National Humanities Center will provide answers and insights. That's Marx and Freud in the 1980s, this week on Soundings.